The subject of this chemistry cassette is iron selective electrodes, and it has been prepared and is spoken by Dr. Arthur Covington of the University of Newcastle upon Tyne. The tape is accompanied by a workbook, and you should have this with you as you listen. And please make certain that you have carefully read the section headed How to Use the Chemistry Cassette before you start. And now here is Dr. Covington.
In this chemistry cassette, I'm going to introduce you to iron selective electrodes and how they are used. The ground I'm going to cover is set out in frame 1, so you might like to stop the tape for a minute or two while you read it through. The name iron selective electrodes is applied to a range of membrane electrodes, which ideally respond selectively towards one particular cation or one particular anion in the presence of other cations or anions. By the word membrane, I mean a thin section of electrically conducting materials separating two solutions across which an electrical potential develops. I'm therefore using the word membrane in its broadest sense. I'm not saying that the membrane is permeable to any of the ions. If you refer to frame 2, you will see a membrane flanked by two solutions, 1 and 2. To measure the electrical potential across this, we need a reference electrode in each of the two solutions. In practice, it's convenient to keep one of the solutions constant and place it, and its associated reference electrode, inside a tube which has the membrane at one end. This is the arrangement used in the well-known pH-responsive glass electrode. In frame 3, I have shown a pH glass electrode compared with one form of iron selective electrode, the solid-state type. You will see that they are in fact very similar. The actual form of construction only differs because glass can be easily made in the form of a bulb, but we cannot do this with other materials. However, glass electrodes can be made from thin glass sections too. The glass electrode responsive to hydrogen ions can be regarded as the forerunner or grandfather of the current range of iron selective electrodes. It was discovered at the back of the turn of the century, whereas iron selective electrodes generally came into use in the late 1960s. Because of the special nature of the hydrogen ion, and because the pH glass electrode is so widely used, it tends to be regarded as outside the term iron selective electrodes. I shall not therefore say very much about it. Now, many different types of substance can be used as the basis of iron selective electrodes. I'm going to refer to these as electroactive materials, and there are three basic types, which you can see classified in frame 4. They all have one feature in common, that is a particular affinity for one kind of iron, that is the iron to which the electrode is selective. How the electroactive species is formed into a membrane depends on its chemical and physical properties, so before I discuss the various forms of electrode in detail, I will say a little more about the different types of electroactive material listed in frame 4. These fall into three main classes. First, glass, which I've already mentioned. Second, the insoluble inorganic salts. These are the ones you've met in elementary chemistry, such as the silver halides, and the insoluble sulfides of metals, such as silver, lead, and copper. The third class is a rather mixed bag of organic ion exchangers, chelating agents, and ionophores. These are often the materials used in solvent extraction of metals, such as tri-N-butyl phosphate used in the extraction of uranium salts. Ionophores is a term used by biochemists for organic molecules which selectively bind and transport metal ions. You will appreciate that more than one of these terms may be applicable to a particular substance. Some of these substances are used in solid form, perhaps dispersed in an inert, or supposedly inert, binder or matrix. Others are dissolved in an organic liquid, which is immiscible with water, to give liquid ion exchange electrodes. In frame 5, I have classified the various electrode types. Solid membranes may be either homogeneous, that is single phase like a crystalline substance, or they may be heterogeneous or two phase, as when a solid material is dispersed in a binder, such as a polymer like polyvinyl chloride, PVC, or silicone rubber. The distinction may not be obvious to the eye, even under an optical microscope. Some glasses which are transparent are in fact two-phase. Liquid membrane electrodes can be unsupported with the liquid kept in a capillary tube, though this is not very practical. It is more convenient to support the liquid on a porous polymer of some sort, such as cellulose ester, which is like filter paper, or on porous glass, or even porous carbon. Frequently, a disc is made from a gel of the liquid in PVC. Mostly, then, the electroactive material is made into a solid disc of some form, and in a moment we'll look at some of the ways that these have been incorporated into usable and commercially available electrodes. The insoluble salt type, in the form of a single crystal or a pressed disc, can be in the form already shown in frame 3. Some commercial forms actually dispense with the inner filling solution completely. In these, the solid reference electrode material is evaporated onto the inside surface of the disc. These are often called all-solid-state electrodes. The inner reference potential may not be very firmly defined. Indeed, in some systems, it's not clear what reactions give rise to the potential. For example, the pH glass electrode will work if it is filled with mercury. Why it works is not very clear, but if the mercury is slightly wet, the inner reference electrode system could be mercury-mercury oxide, which is reversible to hydroxide ions. It is possible to combine the outer reference electrode in the side of the electrode body to make a combination or dual electrode, which we'll see in frame 6. This is like the dual pH electrode, which you may have come across already for laboratory pH measurements. If the membrane is liquid and supported on cellulose ester, this has to be clamped firmly in position so that the organic phase, fed from a reservoir of fluid, properly separates the two aqueous solutions. One way of doing this is shown in frame 7. And a flow-through adaptation of this is also shown. I suggest that you stop the tape for a few moments while you study this. Well, devices like this are fiddly to assemble, but are all right with a little bit of experience. However, they have been replaced commercially by a sort of wick electrode shown in frame 8, where the reservoir of organic liquid is held in a porous, spongy material wrapped round with a cellulose ester bag. Alternatively, the cellulose ester membrane support can be clamped between O-rings, and this arrangement is also suitable for PVC impregnated membranes, which are then easily replaceable. If you're going to make your own electrodes, you can simply glue a PVC disc on the end of a piece of PVC tubing with PVC cement. PVC cement is just PVC dissolved in tetrahydrofuran, THF. An alternative to cellulose ester as support material is shown in frame 9. In this, porous carbon, which is electrically conducting, is used as support material. Then the internal filling solution can be dispensed with. The carbon rod is simply impregnated with electroactive material on its surface and electrical connection made by a metal screw to which a copper wire can be attached. This is the selectrode available from the Danish firm of Radiometer. I now want to return to a detailed discussion of the three types of electroactive substance that I listed earlier in frame 4. Right, let's start with glass. In frame 10, I have listed some of the ions to which glass can be made to show a response. For pH glass electrodes, the glass composition has to be rather special, and in the 1930s, a simple sodium calcium silicate composition, known as Corning 015, was used. This was superseded by lithium barium silicates with small additions of other oxides in the 1950s. Modern pH glasses are complex and often secret formulations. The use of lithium instead of sodium reduced the sodium error of the glass electrode, which was significant at pH greater than 9. Actually, it also raised the lithium error, but this doesn't matter, as we do not often encounter lithium ions in most solutions usually monitored. However, if alumina, aluminium oxide, is added, the sodium ion error is enhanced. So it is possible, by varying the composition of the glass, to make a sodium ion responsive glass electrode. By using another composition, we can make a potassium ion responsive electrode. However, in acid solutions, these electrodes still respond to hydrogen ions. In other words, these electrodes are not perfectly selective to a single ion. That is a point I shall return to later, because all iron selective electrodes suffer from this fault to some degree. Introduction of iron oxide instead of aluminium oxide can be used to make a glass redox electrode. This shows a redox function because it responds in the same way as a platinum or other inert electrode does to a redox couple, such as iron 2, iron 3 in solution. Of course, not all glasses contain silica, and some interesting non-silicate glasses have been discovered which respond to metal ions such as copper 2+, iron 3+. There could be scope for some new developments along these lines in the next few years. Now look at frame 11. This gives examples of my category of insoluble inorganic salts. The simplest to start with are the silver halides. Of course, conventional silver-silver halide electrodes are well known and can be made for all halides except silver fluoride, which is soluble in water. These are examples of what are known as electrodes of the second kind. I've explained this term at the end of the book in Appendix 1 for those not familiar with it. However, for iron selective electrodes, the silver chloride, bromide or iodide, is used without silver metal in the form of compacted discs. The absence of the metal means that the iron selective electrode is not prone to redox potential interference, as are conventional silver-silver halide electrodes. That is, it would work in the presence of, for example, permanganate. To be useful as an iron selective electrode, the electroactive material has to have a solubility at the 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus 6 moles per cubic decimeter level or below. But, unlike the conventional electrode, there is an additional requirement that the material must be an electrical conductor. However, it is possible to make an iron selective electrode where the corresponding conventional electrode cannot exist. For example, neither lanthanum nor barium metal is stable in contact with water, so that conventional lanthanum-lanthanum fluoride or barium-barium sulfate electrodes are not feasible. However, a lanthanum fluoride, fluoride-responsive electrode is one of the most important ion selective electrodes. I will discuss it in detail later. The barium sulfate electrode has been studied, and some apparently satisfactory results reported, but most people think that pure barium sulfate is an insulator. Ion selective electrodes for copper 2, lead 2, and cadmium 2 can be made by adding a second, less insoluble salt, thus turning an anion-responsive electrode back into a cation-responsive one. Thus we start with silver sulfide and add the appropriate copper, lead or cadmium sulfide. In the same way, the fluoride electrode can be turned into a calcium electrode, but calcium fluoride is really too soluble for the electrode to be very useful. More involved still is the sulfate electrode, in which a third insoluble salt, lead sulfate, is added, and this is shown in frame 11. Finally, let us come to my third category of organic materials, shown in frame 12. These materials can be subdivided into three groups, depending on whether the organic ligand is positively, negatively, or zero charged. All these materials must be water insoluble, and hence have lots of hydrophobic groups. For anion-responsive electrodes, the long-chain alkyl ammonium salts are useful, or the substituted orthophenanthrolein salts of nickel 2+, or iron 2+. For cation-responsive electrodes, the long-chain alkyl phosphoric acid salts are used. Another example is a modification by chlorination of the phenyl rings of the well-known insoluble potassium salt, potassium tetraphenylborate. Very important in this category are the neutral carrier types of ionophores. Most of these are naturally occurring, such as the antibiotic valinomycin, shown in frame 13A. Valinomycin has a strong affinity for K+ over the other alkali metal ions. It is possible to synthesize special organic ligands for this purpose. Two examples are also shown in frame 13. B is a polyether or crown complex, which is somewhat similar in function to valinomycin in that it wraps itself round the cation. Here it is seen coordinated to potassium. C is a diazoalkene diamide, one of many similar substances synthesized for this purpose as potential ionophores. The prospect of tailoring ligands to make them selectively complex ions is an exciting and challenging one, requiring many aspects of chemistry in its solution. Finally, in this first part of the tape, I want to mention two types of modified ion selective electrodes, which I call double membrane electrodes, but which others prefer to call sensitized electrodes. There are two principal forms of these listed in frame 14. First, electrodes which respond to gases. Second, electrodes which respond to enzymes. In the frame, there is a diagram showing how they are constructed. Frame 15 lists some of the gases that can be determined with gas-sensing electrodes. The first one to be introduced was the carbon dioxide electrode. This works by the principle that the carbon dioxide gas diffuses through a gas-permeable membrane, altering the pH of a bicarbonate buffer, and the pH change is detected by a pH glass electrode. Diffusion through the membrane may be a slow process, even if the membrane is made very thin, so the time response of gas electrodes is not as fast as with some other ion-selective electrodes. The physical construction of a gas-sensing electrode is shown in frame 16. And frame 17 shows an interesting modification, the air gap electrode. In this, the membrane is omitted and the gas dissolves in a thin film of the bicarbonate buffer on the surface of the pH glass electrode. Other important members of this family are the sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides electrodes, which are important in pollution monitoring of stack gases. Enzyme electrodes are somewhat similar in form. An enzyme coating is placed on the surface of an ion selective electrode, either as a solution by restricting it by a thin membrane, or by forming a plastic membrane containing the enzyme on the surface of the ion selective electrode. The immobilized enzyme catalyzes the decomposition of the species which we wish to determine, producing an ion which is detected by a suitable ion selective electrode. The type first developed used urease, an enzyme that catalyzes the decomposition of urea to give ammonium ions, which can be determined with a cation-responsive glass electrode. This and other examples are shown in frame 18. You should note that these double membrane ion-selective electrodes extend the range of species determinable by ion-selective electrodes from ions to neutral species. In frame 19, I have summarized the principal forms of ion selective electrodes which have been made. Many of them are commercially available. Some tend to be very expensive, ranging up to as much as £250 for a fluoride electrode. Provided you can get hold of the materials, most are fairly easy to make in the laboratory, although their performance may not be quite as good as the commercially available ones. We are now at the end of the first part of this tape. In part two, I'm going to discuss the selectivity, or lack of it, of ion selective electrodes, how to use them in analytical problems, and finally, in part three, to discuss four of the most important in some detail. Now is a convenient time to look back through frames 2 to 19 and make sure you've understood everything so far. No ion selective electrode is entirely responsive to just one kind of ion in solution. None of them are as ion selective as we would like them to be. For example, the pH glass electrode shows an alkaline error in sodium hydroxide solutions, which is due to its response to the sodium ions in solution as well as to the hydrogen or hydroxide ions. Response to another ion as well as to the primary ion is called an interference, and it often occurs because the interferent ion is similar chemically to the primary ion. In the absence of interfering ions, an ion-selective electrode develops a potential, relative to a suitable reference electrode, such as that used in pH measurements, the saturated calomel electrode, according to the Nernst equation, shown in frame 20. This occurs over a concentration range of primary iron of about 10 to the minus 1 to 10 to the minus 5 mole per cubic decimeter. We can test this by carrying out measurements with known concentrations of primary iron and determining a calibration curve as shown in frame 21. There are deviations from the straight line at both low and high concentrations. The deviation at low concentrations eventually becomes horizontal and indicates the lower detection limit of the electrode. I will return to this later. In the presence of an interfering ion, the potential, with respect to the reference electrode, is given approximately by the equation 1, which is usually called the Nikolsky-Eisenman equation, in frame 22. It was first derived to explain the alkaline error of pH glass electrodes. Here, Kij is called a selectivity coefficient. It used to be called a selectivity constant, but it isn't very constant if the conditions under which it is determined are varied, so the word coefficient is preferred to the word constant nowadays. I is the primary ion and J the interferent ion. The form of the Nikolsky-Eisenman equation I've written in this frame as equation 1 is for both primary and interferent ions being singly charged, that is, both are monovalent ions. If one of the ions is divalent, we use equation 2, which is a little bit more complicated. For there to be a selective response to a primary ion, I, Kij must be small. If it is 10 to the minus 3, that means the electrode is 1,000 times more selective towards ion I than to ion J. In other words, an interference limit of J concentration approaching 1,000 times the concentration of I can be tolerated before the interference produces significant error. The selectivity coefficient therefore gives us an indication of how selective an ion-selective electrode is. Manufacturers list selectivity coefficients as a guide to users. A selectivity coefficient greater than 1 in a manufacturer's listing suggests that that particular electrode really responds to an interferent ion in preference, but that particular interferent ion may not be often encountered in practice as a contaminant of unknown solutions whose analysis is required. A so-called water hardness electrode is available, which responds equally, or almost equally, to calcium and magnesium ions. This is an example where a poorly selective calcium electrode can be put to good use in the analysis of hard water samples. Selectivity coefficients are measured by one or other of basically two methods. The first, called the separate solution method, is simple, but may give incorrect or misleading values. It uses two solutions, one solution of the primary ion and one of the interferent ion. If the concentrations of the two ions I and J are the same in the separate solutions, then, as frame 23 shows, the selectivity coefficient can be obtained directly from the difference in potential readings against the same reference electrode. The more reliable and preferred method is called the mixed solution method. First of all, a calibration curve, like that shown earlier in frame 21, is constructed by measuring the potential of an ion-selective electrode in solutions of various concentrations of the ion to which it's primarily responsive. Then, the ion-selective electrode is used in solutions containing various concentrations of that same ion, plus a fixed, usually high, concentration of the interferent ion. A typical result is shown in frame 24. As the ratio of concentration of interferent iron to primary iron is increased, then eventually the electrode shows no response to the primary iron at all, and the line becomes horizontal. The simplest way to read the selectivity coefficient from the graph is, as you'll see in frame 25, to find the value of the potential in the calibration solutions, which is the same as that of the horizontal limit. This graphical construction is shown in frame 24. Alternatively, one can use solutions of varied interferent iron concentration and fixed primary iron concentration. This situation is shown in frame 25. The method of obtaining the value of the selectivity coefficient graphically is similar. Of course, more sophisticated computer techniques, in preference to graphical methods, have been worked out for determining selectivity coefficients by solution of the Nikolsky-Eisenman equation. It is hardly worth it, as the selectivity coefficient can vary quite a lot with the level of interferent iron used. Actually, as you may know, the potential of an electrode varies in the Nernst equation with the activity, the effective concentration, not the actual concentration of the iron in solution. And activity is a function of the overall concentration of all the ions in solution, expressed as the ionic strength. This term is explained in Appendix 2, if you're not familiar with it. It is not usually worth trying to make corrections for this effect. It is not significant except at ionic strengths greater than 10 to the minus 1 mole per cubic decimeter. A further complication is a change in liquid junction potential at the reference electrode, a point I will return to later. The selectivity coefficient is best regarded as an approximate quantity, useful as an indicator of electrode sensitivity. In the simple case of, for example, bromide interference on a silver chloride ion selective electrode, the selectivity coefficient can be successfully related to the solubility products of the two silver salts, but this is not possible for non-solid state types. Frame 27 lists some values of selectivity coefficients for interferences suffered by a few of the principal electrodes commercially available. Differences between manufacturers' quoted values may indicate the uncertainty in the determination of selectivity coefficients, or that the electroactive materials are different. Well, let us now see how we actually use iron selective electrodes. Let us assume that a suitable iron selective electrode is available for an ion we wish to measure. How then do we go about using it? First of all, we need a measuring instrument, which can be a high-quality pH meter. I say high quality because it needs to be able to measure with a precision of 0.1 millivolts. We can understand this by looking at the calculation shown in frame 28. Over a range of concentrations from 10 to the minus 1 to 10 to the minus 5 mol per cubic decimeter, which is the usual concentration range over which we can use an iron selective electrode, the potential calculated from the Nernst equation changes by 236 millivolts for a singly charged ion and by 118 millivolts for a doubly charged ion. In contrast, we have about 830 millivolts for pH measurements with a glass electrode. Put differently, 1 millivolt corresponds to 4.7% uncertainty in concentration for a monovalent ion. This value is the same independent of the actual concentration level because of the logarithmic relation between potential and concentration. If our iron selective electrode does not have a high electrical resistance, a digital voltmeter, or DVM, can be used in the absence of a pH meter. DVMs, or digital multimeters, DMMs, which can cope with electrode input impedances of 10 to the 7 ohms, are becoming very common in laboratory instruments. An input impedance 3 orders of magnitude greater than the electrode resistance is necessary to avoid errors. Typically, glass electrodes have resistances of 100 to 500 megohms, and other iron selective electrodes 1,000 times less. Next, we need a reference electrode. This is usually, as I have said, a calomel electrode with potassium chloride solution forming a liquid junction with the test solutions as in pH measurements. If chloride ions or potassium ions are likely to interfere with the measurements, then an intermediate bridge solution is introduced. Some examples are listed in frame 29. It would be silly, for example, to risk a high concentration of potassium ions from potassium chloride leaking into our test solution if we were trying to measure low-level potassium. Equally, we must avoid choosing an ion in the bridge solution which was a strong interferent for our chosen electrode. However, changes in liquid junction potential may occur when the test solution is changed. The three methods of using these electrodes are summarized in frame 30, and I will discuss each in turn. Direct potentiometry consists of constructing first a calibration curve, as I explained earlier in frame 21. The unknown is then found by interpolation. If the electrode shows a near theoretical slope, a two-point calibration is sufficient, with the two points, one on each side of the unknown. This procedure is called bracketing and is used in pH measurements. In order to reduce the effect of changes in liquid junction potential and to maintain activity coefficients constant, it is often helpful to bring all the solutions to a constant ionic strength by addition of an inert electrolyte. By inert, I mean one that does not contain possible interfering ions. Suitable solutions are available commercially for certain purposes, and additionally, these may contain reagents to complex interfering ions which may be present. An example is the use of citrate to complex iron 3 or aluminium 3, which interfere in the determination of fluoride in public water supplies with the fluoride ion electrode. One of the most important interferents may be hydrogen ion, and it is usual to buffer the test solution to a known pH where interferent effects are minimized, or to ensure all the ion being detected is in the required form, if it can take part in pH-dependent equilibria, as do, for example, ammonium ion or sulfide ion. The second technique is called known increment method, of which there are four variants. In known addition, a few increments containing the sensed ion are added to the test solution. From the change in measured potential on addition, and the potential before additions were made, the original concentration of sensed ion in the test solution can be found. You could look at Appendix 3. In known subtraction methods, a ligand is added to remove the sensed ion. The electrode only responds to the uncomplexed ion, and the original concentration is found in a manner similar to known addition. In variants of these methods, the test solution, which is called the analate, is added to a standard solution with which it reacts. The change in potential of an ion selective electrode to an ion in the standard solution is measured. This is called analate subtraction method. One can have analate addition too. In potentiometric titration techniques, the disadvantage of the low accuracy of direct potentiometry and increment techniques is overcome, because in the region of the equivalence point in the titration, the change in potential is considerably greater than that between the calibration and test solutions. Further, the indicator electrode does not need to have near theoretical slope, and provided the change in potential near the equivalence point is 50 to 100 millivolts, it can be satisfactorily located, if necessary, by special plotting or display techniques. The ion selective electrode may be chosen to respond to the titrant or titrand as appropriate. Precipitation and complexometric titrations have been studied. In this third part of the tape, I want to talk about four important ion selective electrodes: to anion and to cation responsive. First of all, I've chosen the fluoride electrode, which undoubtedly is the best and most important next to the pH glass electrode. Although there were some early attempts to use the mineral fluorite, naturally occurring calcium fluoride, success in finding a fluoride responsive electrode came with the use of single crystal lanthanum fluoride prepared for use in laser technology. Lanthanum fluoride has a very low solubility product, about 10 to the minus 24 moles per cubic decimeter to the fourth. And doping the crystal with europium iron lowers its resistivity. Other rare earth fluorides can be used, as frame 31 shows. Unlike most other iron selective electrodes, the fluoride responsive electrode does not suffer extensively from interference from other ions. Hydroxide iron causes problems at high pH, not because of its similar ionic radius to the fluoride ion, but because of the formation of basic fluorides on the electrode surface. At low pH, there are also deviations from the Nernst equation, but these are due to the chemistry of the system, that is, the formation of the species HF and HF2-. The lower limit of response of the electrode in sodium fluoride solutions is typically 10 to the minus 6 moles per cubic decimeter, but as you will see in frame 32, by making use of fluoride complexing cations such as thorium-4+ and zirconium-4+, the response can be extended down to 10 to the minus 9 moles per cubic decimeter. The electrode is principally used in direct potentiometry, but can also be used in precipitation titrations with lanthanum or thorium nitrate as titrant. There is an example of this in frame 33. Principal applications of the fluoride electrode are determination of fluoride in drinking water and toothpaste, and fluorine, after conversion to fluoride, in organic compounds. The other three iron selective electrodes that I want to discuss in some detail are all so-called liquid ion exchanger types, and can be used in liquid or PVC form. As with the fluoride electrode, there is no nitrate selective electrode of the conventional type, because there are no insoluble nitrates on which an insoluble salt type could be based. Long-chain alkyl ammonium salts can be used in appropriate form as anion responsive electrodes for nitrate, chloride, perchlorate, carbonate, and tetrafluoroborate, but they're not very selective. Nitrate electrodes based on tetraheptyl to tetradodecyl side chains suffer principally from chloride interference. Impurities such as the trialkyl hydrogen salt must be removed to diminish hydrogen ion interference at low pH. A better system is shown in frame 34. This is the originally devised system based on an alkyl substituted 1,10-phenanthrolein metal 2 salt in a nitroaromatic solvent. As might be expected, nitrite also interferes. More applications could be found if these selectivity problems could be overcome. The most important application is to nitrate analysis in river waters, where nitrate accumulation from fertilizer runoff can interfere with the ecological balance of fish and plant growth. The first commercial calcium electrode, shown in frame 35, was based on a calcium organophosphate, calcium bis diendecyl phosphate, dissolved in an organophosphonate solvent, dienoctyl phenyl phosphonate. The long alkyl chain is necessary to prevent water solubility. It is a diester because monoesters form mixed complexes with hydrogen ions and hence show some pH response. Diesters of phosphoric acid show little tendency to form complexes with the alkali metals. The choice of solvent allows good selectivity for calcium over magnesium ions. A less polar solvent, for example decanol, which does not selectively solvate calcium in preference to magnesium as does the phosphonate, gives equal response towards these two ions and is used in the water hardness electrode that I mentioned earlier. The lower limit of response is controlled by the solubility of the calcium salt in water, about 4 times 10 to the minus 5 moles per cubic decimeter, and the upper limit by the extraction of calcium ions from the aqueous solution into the organic phase. Theoretical Nernstian response of 29.4 millivolts per tenfold change in calcium ion concentration is observed over the range 10 to the minus 1 to 10 to the minus 5 moles per cubic decimeter, as can be seen in frame 36. Less hydrogen-iron interference can be obtained with calcium bis di-N-octylphenyl phosphate, which, because of its greater electrophilic nature, does not tend to form adducts with its parent acid. Frame 37 shows the results of a potentiometric titration. A neutral carrier for calcium, a dioxyalkane diamide, has been made. I mentioned this earlier in frame 13C. To name it is quite a mouthful, so I won't. Note in its structure the five oxygens, which are possible coordination sites for the calcium ion around which the molecule or ligand wraps itself. The ability of certain ligands to adopt a conformation which is just right for a particular ion is much used in nature. The neutral carrier macrocyclic antibiotic valinomycin, which was shown in frame 13A, has six oxygens which form a cavity of the correct size to complex potassium, but not the other alkali metals. An iron selective electrode based on valinomycin dissolved in diphenyl ether, or a nitroaromatic hydrocarbon, is an excellent electrode for potassium, with a much improved selectivity for potassium over sodium by a factor of 1,000 compared with the potassium iron responsive glass electrode. Synthetic compounds which use the same principle are the crown compounds. Some typical polycyclic ethers, or crowns, are shown in frame 38, and some synthetic ligands in frame 39. Their ether oxygens form a cavity into which an ion may fit. If the ion is too large, then 2-to-1 complexes may be formed. So far, no crown has been made which is as selective for potassium over sodium as valinomycin. Calcium and potassium ion selective electrodes are important in clinical medicine, where instruments have been developed for routine analysis of blood and body fluids and for continuous monitoring of patients' levels of these ions during surgical operations. Improved measurement techniques will lead to an increased understanding of the role of ionized calcium versus bound or complex calcium in body fluids. In this tape, I have tried to give you an introduction to these new potentiometric sensor devices, which are now widely used in many analytical procedures. They are by no means perfect devices, but improvements are being made all the time. I do hope you will have the opportunity of trying out iron selective electrodes in the laboratory. In Appendix 3 of the booklet, I've given three problem calculations for you to try. Please have a go at them. They'll help you to consolidate what you've learned from this tape. You will find the answers at the end of the book. I hope I have aroused your interest and you will want to find out more. So I have given in frame 40 a short list of books which can be recommended as a next step in your studies.